Welcome to Inspiring Futures. I'm your host, Ed Cotton. This is a podcast where we talk about the how, what, and why of the future.
We're off to the races and we're off to go. Okay, welcome to another episode of Inspiring Futures. Jeff Sweat is my guest again. I think you might remember we had a conversation a few months ago. But this is the Jeff Sweat 2.0. the writer, the author that we're going to devote the whole of this episode to. Jeff, what do you tell us about your, you know, because I know you have a background in writing. So to just tell us a little bit about your writing trajectory. Were you a brilliant scholar? Were you a literature aficionado? Was writing something you took on early and got a skill in early?
It's funny. I get this question a lot, especially, you know, in advertising. I think all of us want to be writing something, and you know, they always ask, well, how did you happen to become a novelist, you know, after all this time? The answer is I actually set out at the beginning of my career to be a novelist. That I just only arrived at it a few years ago, like a lot of things in life. So I think I probably knew from the time I was 10, 11 years old that I wanted to be a writer. It was something that just always clicked for me. And so I took all the journalism and yearbook and creative writing classes during high school. Went to Columbia with the idea that I would focus on journalism as a way to become an author.
Were you part of the Columbia journalism program?
No, I was undergrad. And the funny thing was, is I went there and I thought, partly because they had this great journalism program, and I thought, well, they'll have a great undergrad journalism program. Turns out, no, it's only master's. In fact, they didn't have any journalism courses. They had some great, you know, obviously everything else, but and a great student paper, but they didn't have undergrad journalism. But it's one of those things that it's really interesting, because I think I grew up in Idaho, where there aren't a lot of writers. I had no real role models for how to make a living as a writer until I got into high school, and my high school teacher, Ron Bennett, who taught journalism, you know, was also a stringer for the local paper. So it was the first person I met who like had been able to make some kind of living as a writer. And everybody I talked to gave me advice that essentially said, don't be a writer. You know, like there's no way to make a living at it. And so from an early age, started hedging my bets, you know, and maybe that's not a horrible thing. You know, I don't think I was ready to write a novel yet, but I decided I'm not going to go try to be a novelist off the start. I'm going to start in journalism, because that way I'll be kind of adjacent to it. And kind of along the way, I kept on taking these steps that, were intended in some ways to allow me to stay close to the creative part, but ultimately ended up making me veer away for a while, you know. So I went into journalism, but I couldn't afford to take one of the unpaid internships at like the New York Times or the places that I really wanted to write for. So I went into tech journalism as sort of like a way to kind of get in there. And that took me in a completely different direction. And I realized that journalism was something that was great for the craft of writing, not so much for the art of writing. Like, you know, I really got great at writing quickly, writing well, but there's not a lot of heart in what I was creating, you know? And the other thing that happened was I became physically exhausted, from all the writing I was doing. I always say it's like the only job in the kind of creative industry that is probably more taxing than advertising, because it's lots of late nights. You're constantly producing. You know, there's not like a concepting period, you know, you're just on all the time. And so, and I developed like carpal tunnel problems and things like that. And at the end of the day, I'd come home and I just literally couldn't turn on the computer. Like I couldn't stand to look at it for a second. And so I didn't really write during that period. And I actually left journalism because I wanted to focus on the creative side. And I was able to do some stuff, but then got pulled into Yahoo, where I was, you know, where I was focusing on content marketing, and then came into the advertising world where I was focused on PR. And I feel like I always say every time someone put a ladder in front of me, I would figure out how to climb it. And I, you know, I'm ambitious enough that I wanted to be really good at whatever I was doing, but then that ended up sort of distracting me from ultimately from writing. And when I was 40 something years old, I had an idea for my books, that the one that I ultimately wrote, in my head for a while. And I just sort of thought, you know, I'm in my 40s. Like, if I'm going to do this, I'm not sure when this is going to happen, if not now. You know, and so I did, and several years later, I have a couple of books under my belt. So that's my very long and circuitous route to becoming a writer, which was the thing that I always considered myself in the first place.
So it was literally fear that drove you to putting pen to paper.
I think so. I mean, I think like it was fear and sort of maybe a lack of understanding of kind of like how the world works and the economy works, you know, this feeling that I may not be able to make a living on it. I mean, the funny thing is you make no money as a journalist either. I'm not sure why I thought that was like a better choice. It was basically feeling like I couldn't go there. I also think it's just once you, fear and distraction, I think, are the two things. It's when you, I truly love the things that I've done over the years. So it's partly just, you know, putting myself into that for a while.
So you mentioned you came up with the idea for the topics that you were going to write about, the idea a while before you actually put them on paper.
Yeah. Yeah, probably a couple of years. And it was the kind of thing, you know, and everybody in LA has an idea for a story.
Were you sort of writing things in notebooks as you?
Yeah. And this one kind of came to me, you know, kind of early on. So one thing I think that's helpful to know is that everybody has their obsessions. For me, I've always been obsessed with the end of the world. You know, the books that I read in high school, you know, even now, they tend to be about humanity coming back from some, you know, crisis. You know, so they're all post-apocalyptic, and it's partly because, I grew up in the 80s in Reagan's America, and you know, we were all fairly sure we were going to die at any time. But then it also is part of, you know, I grew up religious in sort of a very, I guess, millennial-focused religion. You know, that believed that there'd be like a end of the world. You know, that kind of thing, and so. I always say people, you know, people have like kind of they're afraid of the dark, they're afraid of spiders, they have these existential, these kind of like primal fears. For me, it was the end of the world. And so when I started to write, I knew that the first book I wrote, I wanted to write about the end of the world. So then it just became, what's the most interesting way for the world to end? And I came across a study that it talked about, that there were two major population booms in our history, or at least before recorded history. One was when we developed agriculture and we were able to stay in one place and grow. And the other one was when we became old enough as a species to have grandparents, which actually wasn't all that old. It was about 30 years old. But what happened is not only did you have an extra set of hands to make sure that children survived to adulthood, which is obviously key to the species, but you also had, for the first time, memory of, you know, like, these are the plants that are poisonous. These are the places you find water. And you also had impulse control. You had, you know, the ability to not get into conflicts that would wipe everybody out. So for the first time, you could coexist in large groups without killing each other. And so I kind of looked at that and realized that was so important to our society. So I tried to conceive of a world that essentially took all of that away. And so in my book, Mayfly, and it's the sequel, Scorpion, I talk about a world set in this future where there are no adults. Everybody dies at the age of 17. And because of that, they've lost everything that we tend to think of as a society. They've lost science, they've lost literature, and just even the ability to read. They've lost medicine, and they're still surviving, but really not in the way that we sort of view of a civilization.
There's a famous book that has the same premise.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
Yeah, but it doesn't, it only talks about, it focuses on the kids before they're sent to have their organs harvested.
Oh, I was thinking you're thinking Lord of the Flies.
No. This is, I can't remember. I've seen it. So it was actually made into a movie. It's really good. It's a Japanese
writer. Oh, I do know that one. Yeah, I read that one. And I'm blanking on it as well. There were a few of them that I thought of. In fact, actually, one of the movies that I think probably helped spark this idea was Children of Men, which had the opposite premise, which is that no children were born.
Yeah.
And it showed the society in turmoil. And I thought, well, that's a big deal, but like, I feel like it'd be even a bigger deal if there weren't any adults around. But I always kind of view this as that the book is sort of like a combination of Lord of the Flies meets Mad Max, you know, with a little bit of like Goonies thrown in for you know, for fun. But it really was an opportunity to look at what makes us tick as a society.
Yeah. And did you realize this was going to be young adult fiction?
Yeah, you know, I did. I intended it to be from the get-go, and partly because of the subject matter, because of, you know, the fact that no one lives past the age of 17, so it was kind of inherently focused on this world. But also because as a reader, I have found a lot to like about YA. And this was, you know, kind of around the time that like Hunger Games had come out, which I think is a really underrated series of books in terms of just writing style. And as a journalist, I really appreciated kind of this focus on clear writing, on story, clear, simple writing, on story, all that kind of stuff. And so that's kind of where I gravitated to. Although I will say, having written it, kind of about halfway through the process between the two books, I realized that I had not necessarily written a young adult novel as much as I had written a book about young adults. You know, I mean, the people who tend to really, I mean, I have plenty of kids who love it, but the people who seem to really love it are adults. Yeah. And, which is, you know, I mean, the young adult market is not, maybe not surprisingly, is, you know, heavily driven by grownups. I think my book especially is leaned towards that. So I think for my next books, I'm going to be going more towards the adult space, because that's kind of where I'm naturally gravitating.
So having written, being a journalist, character development and plot lines were not something in your arsenal, right? So was that something, how did you...
That was really hard, you know, and it's complicated by the fact that I have ADHD. So I'd never written anything longer than probably 3,000 words, you know, successfully. You know, that's probably not true. It's probably longer than that. But like, you know, my books ended up being around 115,000 words. So it was a huge jump. But yeah, plot was something that I was really nervous about. Because it didn't come naturally to me. Character development, I think I kind of got to it from more of an instinctual level. Like I struggled with it a little bit at first, but what kind of the key for me was when I switched from a single person as a narrator to kind of multiple points of view. It allowed me for the first time to start seeing my characters through other people's eyes. And that's ultimately kind of how I ended up starting to develop them, was by kind of seeing how the other characters perceived them, you know. But on the plot front, it is actually really challenging. I kind of cheated in the first book because I had a specific journey that they had to take. They had to get from point A to point B. And it then became a question of like, what obstacles keep them from physically reaching that, you know, and from understanding kind of what they need to learn. And so I was able to do that. Second book got a lot more complicated because I didn't have the journey, but where I was also, it's kind of expanded points of view so that I was not just talking about this group of kids, these like four kids, but also the people they've encountered along the way, you know? And so it became more epic in scope and it was much more challenging. And actually and this comes back to partly to the ADHD thing, but when you struggle with kind of holding pieces together anyway, the way you deal with that is by developing systems, you know? So I don't know about you, but like I live and die by my calendar. If it isn't there, it doesn't happen, you know? And I check my Asana list and my calendar every morning before I do anything else, because I like have to like kind of like orient myself. And so I started developing systems like that for writing for the second book. And so one of the things I did is I used an app called, or not an app, but an application called Scrivener, which is, I don't know if you've used it, but it's
like a writer's aid or tool.
It's kind of like Microsoft Word in that it is a word processor, and certain things would be very recognizable, but it's meant for writing long form pieces. So books with like specific chapters or things like that. Mm-hmm. And what that allowed me to do was a few things. One is that I could write one scene at a time, and they were sort of discrete units. And so if I wrote it and but ultimately didn't like where I wanted it, I could move it around. And it has kind of like the scene card kind of thing that you see in like, say, Final Draft on the script writing software, where you can move, you know, visualize it, all that kind of stuff. But what I did is I wrote each plot line with like each character's point of view as a discrete plot line. Like with, so I could create an arc for each of those characters of kind of what they were trying to do and their individual challenges. And that allowed me to kind of see kind of how they did that. And so the challenge was then was how do you mix them all together? You know, like, and the very first draft, which kind of came together, I was under an extreme deadline. It was right as I was launching, Mayfly, I was supposed to have the first draft of Scorpion, the follow-up, done. And I just sort of, you know, I'd run out of steam. And so I finished the individual scenes, and then I literally just sort of dragged and dropped them together in what seemed like a pretty approximate order. Didn't read through it at all, like after I put it together, and then I just sent it off to my publisher. And I would say it was not entirely successful. So for the second draft, I had to, you know, make some pretty serious edits. So what I actually used was some mind mapping software. And I took each scene that I was writing and I, again, mapped them out in the kind of the different lines. So rather than outlining, I used a mind map to sort of define what these scenes are and these kind of beats for each person. And then I would mark the ones that I needed to create from scratch, the ones that I had to revise, the ones that I had to, you know, dump all together, that kind of thing. And so that was really effective just as a way of visualizing everything, but I still had to kind of figure out how to make it work from a time point of view, you know. And I was struggling to figure out how to like align these visually so I could see kind of when events had to happen. And I remember thinking, kind of like, if only there was some sort of like tool that graphically let you chart events over time, you know. And what I ultimately ended up using was a Google Calendar. I created like a special Google Calendar that was just for the events of the books. And I set it up with like a place over to have, take place over 3 months. And I started saying, okay, it's going to take 3 days for them to get into this part. And I literally started charting it out, and I color coded each of the plot lines visually on the map, so that if it looked like it was too dense in one area, if I was spending too much time talking about this person, I could move it, you know. And then I was able to take the, once I'd charted it on the calendar, I took it back and mapped it out in the book itself, like with the scene cards. So it was, for me, like it was a huge innovation, but it tapped into kind of the way I work, which is, you know, having these tools to sort of help me manage my thought process.
At any point in the putting together the first book, did you feel like quitting?
You know, I did. It wasn't, I would say I went through like kind of fits and starts. I would write a ton for a while and then maybe not write at all for weeks. And that's challenging. One thing I've learned is that writing works best when you are writing every day. Not partly because you
just read the writers and you read that the best ones really kind of have a plan.
They do. I mean, it's sort of like a ritual almost, like yeah. You know, you wake up at the same time, you go in and you do this and, you know, you pour exactly, you know, 1.5 cups of coffee or whatever. And you, you know, sit down and you get your special robe or whatever it is, that kind of stuff. Like all that, the ritual is really important. But the other thing that's really important is when you're writing every day, the story never leaves you. So what would happen is I would write, I'd go out for a walk, I'd walk the dogs. And as I was writing, sort of all the ideas for the next day would come. And I would either rush home and type quick notes to myself or even dictate notes to myself while I was walking on my phone. So that every day I essentially had I had an outline of what I needed to do the next, or, you know, like every day I created an outline for what I had to do the next day. And it was really effective. And the funny thing is I know that that is true, but as I'm writing my next project, I still have a tough time doing that. But one of the things that helped me finish the first book, because it's really hard. I was working at the time, I was working full time at Deutsch LA and then at 72 and Sunny. It sort of transcended those times. And, you know, as you know, these are not easy work days at all. So I was trying to do this.
Say 4 o'clock, guys, I'm out of here. I've got a book to write.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Too well.
So I wouldn't get home until typically like 8 o'clock or something like, or 9 on a good day. You know, and I'm the father of 3 kids and they were young at the time. So I wanted to spend time with them. But what I ended up doing was the hardest thing to do in writing is not to finish. The hardest part is to get started. I have talked, since I've done this, I've talked to so many journalists and advertising folks who all have ideas for books that, you know, are actually pretty compelling. And the big difference between theirs and mine is that I figured out how to start because it's just so daunting. And so what I did is I took a writing class at UCLA and it wasn't so much for kind of for what it taught me, it was for the deadline. It was a 6-week class. At the end of it, I had 25 pages and that sort of started it off for me. And then the other thing I did was
So that was before you put anything down?
Yeah. Yeah. That was before I had written a single thing.
So you kind of had a sort of refresher and a foundation.
Yeah, exactly. So they gave me some great advice on how to like set up a novel and things like that. But like I said, it was that more of that commitment to show up and have a chapter written, you know, that kind of thing. And so, that really kind of got me going. The other thing I did is that I set a rough date to finish, in a year. And I didn't know if that was possible. I'd never, you know, attempted something at that scale. And as I got closer to the year, to the end of that year, you know, I was making steady progress, but kind of, as I said, going in fits and starts. I'd write a ton in like a week and then nothing for 3 weeks. I decided, you know what, I am actually going to do this. I'm going to finish in a year. And as my incentive, I gave myself a trip to Barcelona after Cannes, which I thought was very generous of myself. my wife was like less enthralled by that because I went by myself, but that's a whole other story. But, you know, there was an actual sort of reward, which was huge. And so I started cranking on it and quickly realized that I had way more ahead of me than I thought. I thought I had about 10,000 words to write, which have been quite doable. Turns out I had more like 25 to 30,000 words to write. And this was in less than a month. So I just started cranking. And at one point I was writing about 3,000 words a day. And I would just say, just for frame of reference, Stephen King writes 2,000 words a day, and he puts out 2 900-page novels a year. You know, so it was it was pretty respectable. But what was happening, because I was coming home so late from work, I couldn't really get going until after the kids went to bed. And that was typically 10:30, 11 o'clock at night by the time I was able to start. And I'd write until about 1 a.m. And I couldn't stay awake. I was struggling. I would be sitting at the table I'm at in this dining room right now, trying to stay awake. And so I ended up creating a standing desk nearby for whenever I was feeling tired, and I'd go right there. And even then I was still falling asleep. I was falling asleep standing up trying to write this thing. And but I kept on cranking, and actually did finish a year to the day. I would say a year to the day and about 15 minutes, which I thought was close enough to count. And I just remember I was standing there and I had a cup of coffee in one hand and a glass of whiskey in the other hand, which seemed about as, appropriate as I could imagine.
That's great. So what about the, because not only are you delving into the art of writing from the journalism background, so you're also dealing with other parties like publishers and editors. Mm-hmm. That's a whole new world to navigate as well.
It is, and I would say I was like successful in some senses and not successful in others, because I had certain expectations of what I wanted to do. I will say that having come up through the channel I did through journalism and advertising made me, I think, really well suited for certain tasks that writers have to deal with, but also kind of raised my expectations of what I thought was possible for the book and what I wanted to do from like my own promotion and things like that. I feel like I was constantly pushing my editor and my publisher to try new things that they weren't accustomed to doing, just because things that I thought could make the book better or that could make the promotion of it better, that kind of thing. The editor front is interesting. And I think this is an important lesson for creative people in general. I talk about on the advertising side, I have two sort of don'ts when I talk about developing creative that's going to be, newsworthy. And one of them is, don't be a fan of your own work. We spend so much time creating things and then trying to protect them from outside influence. And what that ultimately happens is it means we're not really examining the work, what we're doing, and we're not putting pressure on it to make it better. And so the nice thing about being a reporter, and the awful thing about being a reporter, is that you deal with the editors on a daily basis, and you just can't be precious about what it is you write. I had been writing for a while kind of smaller stories, and I wrote my first feature for the magazine I was at the time. Had a great editor, really experienced. And, this is the point where my ADHD and my issues with structure came in, because, it really wasn't sort of set up the way it was supposed to. I gave it to him. This is when we still edited everything in hard copy. And so laid it on his desk. He came back later, and it was just torn to shreds. Everything was like moved around and words are crossed out and, things like that. So I kind of like went, I looked at it and I took it back to him. I had a red pen myself, and I circled like this one paragraph, and I said, "See that? That is the only thing you didn't mess with, And he just kind of looked at me and he said, "I'm sorry. It's just, that's what had to happen, And for me, that was sort of like, has been really valuable as a writer. In fact, maybe one of the best things about it is that it did two things. It made me really comfortable in my own skin about things we were doing, but also pretty comfortable in letting people improve it. And in fact, I told my editor when we were talking about this experience, this philosophy, and I said, I'm not afraid of edits. And I'm not afraid to talk to you about it when I don't agree with them. I said, because the way I look at things, these edits are either going to make the book better, or they're wrong. And I'm comfortable with either of those outcomes, you know, and it worked pretty well. You know, I think there were some edits and some suggestions where I ultimately went in and I rewrote like vast swaths of the book, you know, like I took out like 50,000 words of the first draft of Mayfly and wrote, put back in an additional like 35, you know. It's things like that, like you kind of have to be pretty comfortable.
Did you share with friends and family the first?
I did, you know, and there's different schools of thought on whether you should do that or not. What I would say is if you're gonna do it, make sure that the people you're sharing it with have good literary taste. Because one of the issues I had with my class at UCLA was it's open to anyone. It was a beginning class. And some of the writers were really great and I thought were really insightful. And others had just like the craziest, you know, stories that weren't well written or anything like that. And I just thought, I don't, like, how would you trust that opinion, you know? And so I think what tends to happen, a big mistake that writers make early on is they share their stuff early with people who probably don't know what they're talking about. And they get so discouraged by whatever feedback that they have that they can't ever sort of go beyond that. And that's a big challenge. So I think it's, if you're gonna, Stephen King has a saying. He says, write with the door closed and edit with the door open. So mm-hmm. In his mind, he's like, you know, you can write, you know, put everything down as you want and then sort of open it up to kind of criticism and pressure like I was talking about. Having done this for a long time, I'm pretty comfortable with sort of having people look at along the way. Like I said, because it'll either make it better or they're wrong. So yeah. But I think it takes a lot as a young, like a beginning writer to have to sort of have the confidence and wisdom to open yourself up for criticism.
So is the second book, was it harder or easier?
Oh my gosh, it's so much harder. Don't ever write a second book. Like just skip straight to three. It was harder, you know, partly because it was a more challenging story to tell. It was harder because I was supposed to have it done when Mayfly was launching and I had a ton of kind of launch activities that I was working on. But the one thing that made it hard, which was sort of unforeseen and really was pretty brutal, was I was pretty sick at that time. At first we didn't know why, but I was getting nauseous like every day. I had brain fog. I really couldn't kind of formulate thoughts, had crazy anxiety, and finally figured out that that my family and I had been exposed to toxic black mold. It was behind a shower wall, and the bathroom was right next to my office. So it was the same wall, basically. And so I had been working from home at that point for 2 years and breathing that in, and got really, really sick. And so all those things that I was talking about were all symptoms of the toxic, of the black mold. And those are, anxiety and brain fog are really not great things to be dealing with as a writer. And I just felt like I was just stuck, you know. And so I ended up kind of getting some help along the way from like editorial assistants, just having people to bat ideas off and do some research for me. But ultimately, it just sort of took time. You know, the first draft I did, the one that I talked about where I just kind of threw things together, like it wasn't that great. There were some beautiful parts to it, but like I wouldn't have read that book. The other thing was, is I had originally written it as the second book of a trilogy versus the second and final book of this, of a duology. I think it suffered from that middle book of a trilogy, syndrome. I mean, there's a reason why Empire Strikes Back is the only second installment of a trilogy that anyone ever likes, because it's like a way station, you know. It's just a stopping point or like a step along the way, and you know that it's not gonna end So you kind of just, you're kind of stalling for time. And so that's kind of what it felt like. And one of the decisions was to make this the second and final book. And then it gave me some narrative momentum that really needed. But the other thing I did is I kind of let it sit on the shelf for a couple of months, maybe longer. And I came back to it with a fresh point of view. And I went through and I was pretty merciless. I actually, if there was any scene that bored me, I just took it out. I had like a graveyard of scenes and I just would just dump them. And if there was something to be salvaged in there that I thought was relevant to the plot, I put in another bucket of scenes that could be used somewhere else, you know, like that kind of thing. And, but I was brutal. And I think you have to be, to write. I mean, you really have to be
pretty. How destructive was that process? What were you left with the end of that?
It's funny. I actually probably did cut it in half, if not more, you know, and then I had to start from scratch. But I had a pretty good system for kind of, once I'd done that, this is when I kind of created that system I was talking about of kind of managing it. And one of the things I did was I had a whole bunch of like kind of like fragments of scenes and ideas for scenes that were in one bucket. And that was sort of like almost like random scene ideas. And then I had another folder that was just the scenes that I was actively working on. And I wouldn't put, and then I had a final scene, which was like, you know, which is basically, it was final scene thing. And I wouldn't put anything there until I was 100% comfortable with it. And that's the way I kind of like chunk through it. And sometimes that would be a heavily revised scene that I had to do, or fragments, or a brand new scene. And I would just sort of like kind of blast through them. And I got to a nice rhythm. But I did, and this is like, I can write a lot when I have to, and this is probably the journalism stuff, you know, sort of whenever your deadline is, that's exactly how long it's going to take you for you to finish a project. You know, if you have 3 months, it'll take you 3 months. If it's a month, it'll take you a month. And that was the case with this. I had been kind of like planning for the final round for quite some time. And I kicked it off. I went up to a friend's cabin up in the mountains, and was there for 3 days without, I turned off the Wi-Fi. So it was just, you know, just writing, brought like my keyboard and like an oversized monitor. And I just cranked on it for that time. I'd keep a word count every day of like how many scenes how many words I'd gone through. And when I started, I was at like something like 65,000 words. And in the next 2 months, I put another 60,000 words on the board. Those are partly like new scenes and partly, you know, heavily rewritten scenes, but there were a lot. And, you know, I was probably averaging at some point to points again, 3,000 words a day. At one point I had like a 6,000 word day, which was sort of my record, but, it was pretty brutal, but I think that's okay. Like, I think like I think you should never be afraid to make something better. And I will say like, after all of this, I came out with a book that, I believe is significantly better than the first one. You know, I think because I had gone through so much to bring it to life, it just had a lot more heart, in a lot of ways. You know, I think I had empathy for my characters in a way that I hadn't had before. And in fact, when I reached the end of the book, there were a few scenes that were really tough to write because they're, you know, a lot of stuff kind of emotionally happening there. And I always feel like in order to write something, you have to, at least fiction, you have to be able to feel it.
Yeah.
And so for like 2-3 days straight, I was just like crying, like while I'm typing. And, you know, thank God, like I'm a good touch typist because I couldn't see the screen at certain points. So,
you're emotionally involved with your characters, I guess.
Yeah. So it was draining, but in a way that I think ultimately led to something that I was really proud of.
Did you, do you have ambitions to turn these, or turn this one into something that's more like content, like film or show or?
Yeah. So that was, so with Mayfly, we actually actively, you know, went through that. I technically have an agent at CAA, although I find that you have an agent at CAA if like someone is there to hand you money. Otherwise, you probably don't have an agent at CAA. So I do have a film agent. They shopped it around, and I think when they didn't get a bite, they kind of like paused. But given the pandemic, and given the fact that the premise of my book is that there is a plague that has wiped out all the adults and basically left children, the kids untouched. And so it feels, I kept on having people contacting me like as it started and saying, I can't stop thinking about your book, you know? So I think like there's a resonance that it has now that it didn't have a couple of years ago. Certainly the hopes are there. But you know, if it doesn't sort of go through the traditional route, I do feel like there are stories yet to be told, you know, and if it ends up being something that I sort of like figure out how to make myself, I think it's there. But we've explored things like graphic novels, you know, audiobooks with a full cast, all sorts of things like that. And I think those things will happen over time.
Yeah. So in terms of getting the book into people's hands, is that challenging?
It is. You know, it's what you kind of find out in publishing, and the part that I didn't really know the first time around is that they really kind of have decided kind of before all of this begins that, you know, that they have certain books that they're going to really be pushing, you know, and, you know, essentially if there's a big advance tied to it, they will put that corresponding amount of effort into marketing. And so as an author, you're sort of left to kind of make up the difference, you know? And so, like I hired my own publicist for Mayfly, I did a couple of big, promotions for it. The cat is in. Hang on a sec. I'm going to repeat that, but let me get the cat out really quickly because she's intense. Hold on. I'll be right back. About that. Old houses are not particularly soundproof. At least the doors aren't. One of my big goals was to try to figure out how to expand upon what's traditionally done in book publishing. And I think book publishing is really good at getting it, distributing books to the people who they know are fans. And so one of my goals as an author who has had, experience coming from advertising marketing was how to get it into the hands of people who didn't know they would be fans. And so I would say that still has been my primary initiative. So for Mayfly, we did a couple of things that I think were pretty groundbreaking. One was that we did a partnership with Giphy, where they created gifts for Mayfly and publish them on their homepage. Some of those things that kind of came about simply because I happened to be in the right place at the right time. Mm-hmm. I had met the president of Giphy Studios here in LA at a Fast Company event that was hosted at their offices. And they had talked about how they were working with brands to create promotions and I said at brands and entertainers. And I said, have you ever worked with an author before? She said, no, but we'd like to. And that's really how it started. We ended up doing it for free for us and promoting it because they wanted to be involved. You know, I think that's one of those things where, you know, my background as a marketer has been incredibly valuable in kind of helping get the word out as an author. The other thing that we did was much more involved. It was actually a very, I would say, high-tech scavenger hunt. We created these, we tried to kind of recreate the world of Mayfly and this, what we call LA, it's spelled out E-L-L-A-Y-E. It's all phonetic at this point because no one knows that it was called Los Angeles at one point. So we took some of the landmarks that are mentioned in the book, and we created, as I call it, these apocalypse-sized versions of them. We actually took 360 images, which I went out and shot myself on a borrowed camera that I barely knew how to use. And then I had my nephew, who's a matte painter for Hollywood. He actually went in and like aged these books, so these landmarks, so they would look like what people would have seen, or what our characters would have seen. And then we dropped them into Google Maps, into the images, so that people would kind of encounter them. And there were little clues that they could follow and unlock bonus content. So it was something where we saw a lot of engagement with it. But the thing I will say is that it didn't ultimately drive much in the way of sales. And partly because I didn't control that part of it, because of the more traditional publishing model, but also because I kind of ignored some basic things that as a marketer, I know. I mean, I worked at Yahoo. I know how you build an audience and I know a lot about performance marketing, but I kind of didn't want to do the performance marketing part of it. I only wanted to do the big splash. I didn't have the follow through, which was you created this great content. How do you get people to sign up for your mailing list and engage with you so that you start building a relationship with them? And so I think that's the thing I've learned is you can do the splashy stuff, and that's great. We got a lot of articles written about us, that kind of thing. But if you are not doing the block and tackling that's just part of marketing, then it's ultimately for nothing. You have to have the follow through. So for this one, this book, I have been a lot more chill about it. I actually, one of the things I realized candidly is that I just didn't have the appetite for doing promotion the way I did for Mayfly. And it really kind of, and what had happened, if you were following me, if you were a Facebook friend with me on 2 years ago, that's all you would have seen was me talking about it, and I was really aggressive, and we had this amazing launch event, all those kinds of things. We did the things that we talked about. And this year, as we're getting closer, I realized I hadn't posted a single post about it in months. No one knew it was coming, and I realized that it was actually I was trying to figure out why that was, why that was so hard for me to do. And I realized I really just kind of had I think I had some PTSD from the launch the previous time, because I was so sick during that time, and I just didn't want to go back in. So I've been much more relaxed, but where I have been marketing has really been inclined to drive engagement with people, and one of the things that I think that I'm looking at right now, one of the things that was really successful when we did our virtual launch was we did a full cast reading of Scorpion. And that kind of comes back to my fundamental premise of reaching people who wouldn't normally be fans of the book, know? And I would say, I don't know if you go to book readings a lot, or did when we were allowed to, I never did until, and I read a lot, but I had never been to one until I became an author and I was starting to sort of do research on how to do them right. And I think most people don't, it's just not something that is sort of super entertaining. And so I wanted to make the reading interesting to people who would not necessarily sit there and listen to me for a while. And so what I did is I read the narration, but I brought in a cast of kids to read my characters, teens. These were people that were part of my daughter's theater group, which had a production slated to happen right around now that didn't because of COVID.
Yeah.
So it was an outlet for them, but it also was a way to sort of bring some of these scenes to life. And it was great to see the reaction as we were doing this. People were chiming in on chat, talking about how much they loved it, you know. But the coolest thing was, is a friend of mine called up afterwards to congratulate me on the launch, and he had had his daughter watching with him, and she has resisted reading Mayfly. Like, they've been trying to get her to read it for a while because they thought she'd really like it, and she's just like, and any teenager you talk to right now, their first choice is not to read. Like, they might. I have three kids. You know, my daughter reads occasionally. My boys never. They still haven't finished Scorpion, you know. But she was so enthralled by this reading that she turned to her dad and said, "Hey, can I have that book now? I think I really want to read it." And so to me, that was the ultimate compliment. That's exactly what I'm trying to do, is try to bring these things to life in a way that makes people want to read it. So for me, the next thing that I'm doing, I'm actively working on, is this concept that I'm calling lit theater, which is having authors come in and read with a cast in sort of these live theater type settings. And so I've been experimenting with what you can do on streaming and, you know, using Zoom and green screens and all that kind of stuff to really kind of bring something that is kind of an interesting hybrid. And given the fact that we're still many months away from any kind of live theater, I think it's intriguing. I think there's a lot of room for innovation, and that's the part that I'm kind of excited about right now.
Really cool.
If people want to buy more of my books, that's also great.
Final question, as we're running up to the hour.
Oh yeah, of course.
Is there another book in the works?
There is. So I have two. One is a prequel to Mayfly and Scorpion called The Book of the End. This one would be targeted, you know, fully at adults.
Yeah.
I started writing it, and originally the idea was to like kind of do it in real time as the pandemic progressed, and serialize it and put out chapters. It became a little too real. Like, I started, like, it started,
you couldn't separate
there's not enough distance, and I was just like, yeah, I can't live the pandemic and then write about the pandemic at the same time. So the next book, though, is the one that I'm currently working on actively, is science fiction for adults, but really in kind of the comedy vein. So something like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, mm-hmm, or Good Omens, where it's fairly absurd. But the premise is that it's about 100 years in the future when everything just pretty much sucks. Like, there's nothing good left. We're, you know, overwhelmed by global warming, all the good food, all the good places to live are all gone. And so people, instead of vacationing places in the world, they go back, they take time trips. They go back in time to places, you know, where, you know, they say things like, "I hear 1974 is great this time of year." And so time travel is possible, but only through one guy named Brian. And they essentially license him for everything from pizza delivery to time travel to weapons, you know, defense, that kind of thing. And he's the only form of science that's studied anymore, because they've pretty much banned education. And so they call it Brian Science, which is the name of the book. So that's the idea.
That sounds great.
Yeah, it's fun. And it's sort of this idea that he's traveled through time, and he starts to kind of fall apart. The more he travels, the more he kind of loses himself. But they also, the more the universe starts to fall apart too. So it becomes,
do you have anyone, I always remember the Ray Bradbury, stepping off the trail, stepping on a butterfly.
Oh yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that one has actually stuck with me for a long time. That was instrumental. The other one I didn't realize until sort of after the fact that's been influential is, I realized that Life of Brian, the Brian Science kind of came to me. I don't know if it was like late at night when I wrote it down, but I literally don't remember writing down this idea. And I kind of opened it up in my notes because I keep a running story ideas kind of notebook. And I opened up and I read this and I was like, oh, wow, that's actually pretty good, you know? And so, and I think I kind of came up with the idea of Brian Science as like, just because I liked the way it sounded. Yeah. But I realized that like Life of Brian, like there's more than a few analogies to that.
Yeah, yeah. That sounds great.
Awesome. Yeah, so that's, you know, it's light compared to what I've been doing, but it's a really nice palate cleanser. It's really fun to write comedy for a change.
Light within the darkness.
Exactly. I think it just seemed like a natural thing. I'm like, okay, we got to do something that's just feels absurd, you know, a lot of wordplay. So.
That's good. Well, thank you so much for this chat. Really illuminating, interesting to hear. You know, people have a romanticized notion of before they start doing this they're going to be Hemingway and it's all going to be roses, but you know.
Well, I will say this, and it's my privilege to be here. I really appreciate it. But the one thing I would say, given that I'm sure that a lot of our audience are people who have creative ideas and are creative people, but are maybe not actively doing so. To come back to my earlier point, I think you just have to start. You have to figure out how to carve out place in your life for it, even if it's like 10, 15 minutes a day of doing something creative. And I would say, especially right now in this moment, you know, there's sort of no better time. Like it's something I think that we all need. And this is a great time to be doing this.
That's great. Thank you again.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thanks, Ed.
This is your host, Ed Colton. Thank you so much for listening to Inspiring Futures. Until next time.